Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded September 18th, 2024. Well, few in Canada will likely have heard of Neera Tiruchelvam, but for those in the expatriate Sri Lankan community, the Harvard-educated human rights lawyer, mediator, and champion for peace was, at the end of the last century, the best hope of bringing together the Tamil minority community with the Sinhalese ruling class to avert civil war. His assassination in 1999 put an end to those hopes, and history records what happened next. Sathish Balasundaram is a Canadian Tamil and lawyer involved in left politics out east. Sathish is also a collaborator with Prasanna Shamagutas, the writer, director, producer, and editor of the acclaimed documentary series Truth to the Powerless, on a new project based on the life of Neera Tiruchelvam. Prasanna Shamagutas and Sathish Balasundaram in the first half. And while the news is fresh, today Israel attacked Lebanon. That's hardly news. Israel has been bombing there for nearly a year and much else besides for decades more. But what is new is the nature of the attack. Everyone has heard by now of the pager bombs. As I write, 11 are confirmed dead, with many hundreds more injured. After nearly a year of horrors and crimes never witnessed, it seems we've got further to descend yet. But David Rovix has not been cowed. He says, quote, whatever is happening next, I aim to be singing about it. David's an itinerant singer-songwriter, essayist, and anarchist, fresh from the anticlimactic Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Rovix and partner in musical rhymes Kamala the Good Emmanuel, a.k.a. the Ministry of Culture, are touring the continental Northwest with gigs in Washington State, Oregon, and right up here in B.C., David Rovix and Titanic Entertainment amid the icebergs in the second half. But first, Sathish Balasundaram and Prasanna Shamagutas on the life and times of Neera Tiruchelvam, Sri Lanka's hero for peace. So, gentlemen, welcome to the program. It's been a year and a half since we last spoke, Prasanna. Before getting to the man of peace, what, Prasanna, was Sri Lanka's protracted civil war about, for those of us that don't remember?
So the Sri Lankan civil war, it officially began in 1983, and it was basically in response to the majority community in Sri Lanka, the Sinhala community. The government, they consisted of the government in power, and they were imposing successively discriminatory legislation. And the majority Sinhala community, they were also carrying out ethnic pogroms and attacks against the minority Tamil community. And in response to that, various members of the Tamil community, they began arming themselves. They decided to wage a separatist war against the Sri Lankan government for their own separate state in the predominantly north and east of the country, which is where a majority of Tamils live.
Well, and to go to you, Sathish, as a lawyer now, it's been 15 years since the end of the official end of the civil war, at least. And I'm looking at a report from Human Rights Watch that came out on the anniversary of the end of that war in May. And its headline reads, 15 years since Sri Lanka's conflict ended and no justice for war crimes. What area of law are you, Sathish, focused on? Is it to do with human rights? And what's your legal take on the situation in the interim since the end of the war regarding war crimes committed, especially in the last days of the conflict?
Thank you. I actually, unfortunately, do not practice international human rights law. I am just a regular, what I like to call, retail lawyer. I do family law, real estate, and I do wills and estates. So my opinion in terms of the international human rights aspects of what happened in Sri Lanka should be taken with a grain of salt. My take on it is simply an opinion. I believe there were war crimes committed in the months leading up to the conflict. It is possible that it was done by both sides, but certainly the government, I believe, may have engaged in war crimes, and it certainly should be investigated by independent parties. Nobody has stepped forward. The government has not allowed independent parties to come forward and conduct investigations. There were also allegations of a genocide. I initially was extremely resistant to that idea. I felt it was mostly orchestrated by the LTT rump and Tamil nationalists. And at that point, Ban Ki-moon had said as much as 40,000 people may have perished. And I was sort of dismissive of the law, international law lawyer from University of Chicago. I think Prasanna might know his name. I was initially dismissive of that. But what I came to realize during the Gaza conflict mm-hmm. was that even before 40,000 casualties came about, at the time, I think when South Africa brought their case, it was 12 to 13,000, maybe 15,000 casualties. And people were comfortable using the word genocide, at least people on the left. And so I am rethinking my position on genocide, not because I'm an international law expert, but just because I'm a layperson, and maybe I should not have been so dismissive of the allegations that there were genocide. If people are going to say 15,000 to 40,000 people perishing in Gaza is a genocide, well, and what about what happened to the Sri Lankan Tamils at the end of the conflict? There were no fire zones. People were guided into those no fire zones. And then those places were bombed or shelled, and there were significant casualties. So there were, in my estimation, there were definitely war crimes. And did it rise to the level of genocide? Well, perhaps I was too dismissive. Not that I'm an authority, but as a layperson, maybe I was too dismissive.
Well, Prasanna, I like the point being brought up here that you often hear defenders of Israel saying, well, why are you always picking on Israel and not talking about other countries and other conflicts? We saw a lot of what we have been seeing in Gaza, in Sri Lanka, in those last days on that beach when the military surrounded the civilian remnants, cornered them in a concentrated area, and then fired on them with heavy weaponry.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the, I would argue that in the case of Gaza, it's even more brutal than the case in Sri Lanka. But certainly there are parallels in the sense that a community was being led by the government into a very confined space, so-called safe zones in both Gaza and Sri Lanka. And then those areas were being bombarded with massive artillery weaponry and resulting in significant civilian casualties. So in that sense, there is parallel. But what's happening in Gaza, I think, is far worse. There's a far more egregious and blatant violation of human rights. And relative to population, the amount of people being killed in Gaza is far higher.
I would concur with that. The situation in Gaza is much worse than what it was in Sri Lanka. But I was simply referring to the numbers. If you remember back in December, or was it early January, when South Africa brought the case, I think the numbers were 15,000 at most. And recently, Ralph Nader, in an interview with Judge Napolitano, suggested that the casualty rate might be even higher than the Lancet estimation. Lancet estimation of in excess of 200,000, 185,000. Mr. Nader believes that in Gaza it is perhaps as much as 300,000. And so Mr. Prasanna is correct that Gaza is much worse. I was simply referring to what the official numbers are. And most people with the official numbers itself were comfortable of 40,000 or 15,000 back in January were comfortable with using the term genocide. People from outside, like an expert human rights lawyer out of South Africa, It was not just people from outside the Israeli community, sorry, the Jewish community, but people from inside the Jewish community. Omar Bartol, a Holocaust expert, a lot of people were concerned about what was going on as early as mid to late October.
Prasanna, what we've seen as well as parallels, and again noted that the scale is not as the same as what's happening in Gaza. I don't think there is an analog for what's happening in that. But what we do see are a lot of parallels. That, and my point is that Sri Lanka presages a lot of what we've seen: the impunity of government forces using heavy arms against a captured civilian population. We've seen since the end of the war, the introduction in Sri Lanka of anti-terror legislation. That there's just recently a report from the United Nations that the government there is trying to strengthen that legislation. We've seen ethnic cleansing crimes go unpunished. There's impunity entirely. And there's a religious element as well in this that we see in the Middle East conflicts, as well as checkpoints and survivors trying to find family members and being harassed by authorities and so forth. So the parallels interest me more than the details.
It is interesting that you brought up ethnic cleansing. In Sri Lanka, while the Tamils have been victims since independence, they were not hesitant to victimize other communities. So in the 1990s, the LTT basically ordered and ethnically cleansed the north and east, at least certainly the north, of the Muslim population. And even
the LTT, the LTT is the Tamil separatist group. Sorry to interject, Sadish.
Yeah. The Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, also known as the LTT, or just loosely known as the Tigers, they basically exterminated other rebel groups within the Tamil community. They became the leading, and basically Mr. Prabhakaran said he is the sole voice for the Tamils, which we're going to discuss shortly. But the LTT ethnically cleansed the Muslim community, the Tamil-speaking Muslim community of the north, in 1990, and DBS Jayaraj has detailed that in one of his articles. So Tamils were not, and if you speak to a Tamil now, they would still apologize for it. They would look you in the eye and tell you that, oh, they were traitors. They were working with the government. They were exposing our movements, and therefore it was legitimate to ethnically cleanse the north of the Muslim community. And when the government refused to give citizenship to mostly low-caste indentured laborers from India who worked in the tea plantations, the Tamils acquiesced twice in the repatriation of 150,000 indentured Tamil, mostly lower-caste laborers who worked in the tea estates in Sri Lanka. So this was in the 60s, and I believe in the early 70s, there was another repatriation of 150. So about 300,000 people were repatriated to India, and the Tamils stood by. So we definitely faced racism. We, and Prasanna has discussed the pogroms. There was 58, there were pogroms, 77, 83. In 81, the Jaffna Library was burned. I am sorry that I don't know of it. Many other pogroms, whether there were any in the 60s, I'm not aware, or I have not read up on my history on that. But there were pogroms against the Tamils. We were treated as second-class citizens. You speak to many Tamils, and they'll tell you how it felt, how they knew that there was a glass ceiling in terms of jobs and careers in Sri Lanka. And we felt like we were second-class citizens. We saw successive governments pass legislation that was not helping us promote our culture and our growth in that society. But we also victimized others. The Muslim community, the indentured laborers from the tea plantations, we did, and we even killed our own. as we are going to discuss soon, we even killed our own people.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today to Sathish Balasundaram and Pritasana Shamagutas. Please correct me, gentlemen, on my butchering of the pronunciation. I beg your forgiveness in advance for that. Prasanna is the writer and director, producer, and editor of the acclaimed documentary series Truth to the Powerless. We've spoken on this program a couple of times about that show. Together with Sashis, they are embarking on a new project, a film, as mentioned in the introduction, of Neon Tiruchelvam. Perhaps I could begin with you, Prasanna, to tell us who Neon was.
So Neelan Tiruchelvam was a Sri Lankan born academic, constitutional scholar. He received his education in Sri Lanka, but also he received his education in law at Harvard Law School. He was a constitutional law professor, visiting professor at Harvard Law School. His father was also a politician, a senator in Sri Lanka, and his father was fighting for federalism, a federal solution to the ethnic conflict in the 60s, the early 70s, the 50s, when Sri Lanka gained independence in 1948. His father and the party, the political party his father belonged to, the Federal Party, which was a Tamil political party, a minority party in Sri Lanka, they were advocating for a federal solution in Sri Lanka. And so Neelan very much was influenced by his father's views. And Neelan in Sri Lanka, he built institutions that were dedicated towards building knowledge about ethnic pluralism and about diversity, democracy building. And he took those ideas abroad. So he engaged in, he participated in democratic election monitoring in places like Chile, South Africa. Chile, after the dictatorship of Pinochet had ended, he participated in the draft constitution in Kazakhstan after the collapse of the Soviet Union. He took part in formulating the draft constitution of Kazakhstan. Many of his recommendations were actually implemented in the official constitution of Kazakhstan. And so when it came to Sri Lanka, Neelan was given an opportunity because of his renowned expertise in constitutional building. He was invited by a government at the time, the president, Chandrika Kumaratunga, who came to office in 1994, was elected president by an overwhelming majority of the vote, by more than 60% of the national vote, on a platform of bringing an end to the civil war and negotiating a peaceful solution to the end of the civil war. And so she had invited Neelan to take part in drafting a constitution that would finally address the grievances of the minority communities and bring an end to the civil war. This was in 1995, where Chandrika Kumaratunga, then president of Sri Lanka, invited Neelan. And Neelan had contributed towards a proposal known as the Union of Regions proposal, which to date advocated for, as Dr. Tiruchelvam said, it was the, I quote, the boldest attempt to redress the grievances of the minority communities. And by far, the proposals had devolved a significant amount of power from the central government to the regions. It had given the regions of Sri Lanka, including the Tamil-dominated regions of the north and the east, significant autonomy. It had imposed provisions that prevented the Sri Lankan government, the central government, from unilaterally taking away the powers that it gave to the regions. A longstanding grievance of the Tamil minorities is that the Sri Lankan government makes pledges, the Singla government, the Sri Lankan Singla-dominated government, they make pledges, but they do not fulfill those pledges. And so a paranoia among the Tamil communities that the Sri Lankan government would give powers and then unilaterally take them away. So what those proposals did is it made it difficult for the Sri Lankan government, the central government, to unilaterally take away those powers. They were the boldest proposals to date. And when the proposals were released, The LTT became extremely fearful. The Tamil rebel group became extremely fearful. And the LTTE assassinated Neelan Thiruchelvam in 1999 in response, in retaliation to his involvement in collaborating with the government in formulating these proposals.
Yeah, and that's what I wanted to get to with Sathish. Now, it might be a little counterintuitive to see that Neelan, a Tamil himself, was in fact assassinated by the LTTE. Sathish, tell us more. Well, and this and that devolution plan, by the way, that you mentioned in a report written by Mike Marchese, he says it was, quote, the devolution plan that he contributed to was the, quote, the best hope for a lasting solution to the ethnic conflict in Sri Lanka. Sathish, take it away.
So even the theoretician for the LTTE, Anton Balasingham, I think in 2001 or 2002, basically publicly stated that the proposals put forward by Dr. Thiruchelvam were probably the best solution that we could have asked for. It was watered down from 95 through 99 to 2000. With each successive watering down, I don't think Dr. Thiruchelvam would have been pleased by it. It was watered down because of the basically the LTD's position that they wouldn't accept that and the UNP's, United National Party's, opposition to it. The governing party of Dr. Chandrika Kumaratunga was the Sri Lanka Freedom Party, SLFP. And, you know, federalism itself was made into a dirty word in Sri Lanka through perhaps for political reasons, for propaganda reasons. It was made into a dirty word, and that's why sort of the Union of Regions was sort of more used as a more tolerable word, because in the eyes of the Sinhalese majority, if you give federalism and if you give the Tamils an area where there is self-governance, it is only a stepping stone, a hop, skip, and a jump for them to get to an independent state. And that they would, that Tamils would effectively use the northeast areas that they were going to govern to use that to come to a separate state. That obviously was not going well. I shouldn't say obviously, but that was realistically not in the cards or in the plans. We just wanted, as Tamils, a degree of autonomy and self-governance. There was no desire by the leadership, either S.J.V. Chelvanayagam or Dr. Thiruchelvam's father. I've forgotten the first name all of a sudden.
Murugesan
Thiruchelvam. They had never any plans, or there was never any plans to secede from the union. The Indo-Lanka Accord created a solution where it wasn't much of a solution. It was sort of shoved down the throats of the government at that time. And it was they created a concurrent list. So they gave somewhat autonomy, these provincial councils, but using the concurrent list, the government was able to override anything that they did not like. And that is what Dr. Thiruchelvam was trying to get rid of, the concurrent list, and provide a more realistic form of federalism and realistic form of government. But I think you can ask Prasanna this, but I think the 95 proposals were probably the more far-reaching proposals, and then the subsequent watering downs were less and less satisfactory to Dr. Thiruchelvam.
Well, we're fast running out of time, Prasanna, but I want to quote Neelan. In one of his last speeches, he was a member of parliament. In one of his last speeches in the parliament, he was commenting on his colleagues that had been assassinated as the assassination was becoming rife. He said, quote, sadly, the impact of these deaths were only too brief as we uncritically resign ourselves to war, destruction, and political assassinations. writ in a larger sense, Prasanna, what cautionary tales can we take? I still see these parallels between what's happening in Palestine today, a small area with distinct communities and extreme violence and seemingly implacable differences.
In the case of Dr. Thiruchavam, Dr. Thiruchavam was somebody who was advocating for a peaceful solution to end the civil war, and he was vilified in the most vitriolic manner by the Tamil community. He was vilified as a traitor to his people. There were cartoons. We discussed this in the docuseries. There were cartoons that were made of Dr. Thiruchavam that were spread all across the diaspora, the Sri Lankan Tamil diaspora. There were people that were calling for his death. When he died, there were Tamils in Canada who celebrated his death. And all he was advocating was for the Sri Lankan people, the Tamils, the Muslims, the Sinhalese, all these different communities, these heterogeneous communities, to live together peacefully. And he was very much the voice, a voice of reason. When he died, condolence letters were published by Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, by the UN Secretary General, distinguished figures. He had that much of an impact. And I think a lesson that could be taken from his life is that we should listen to individuals of conscience and people who express the need to build consensus, which is what Dr. Thiruchavam was advocating his whole life. He was always like, let's try to find mutual points of agreement among two differing parties. So he was fervently opposed to violence, a military solution, and he would have been horrified by the way the war ended. And till the last minute, he would have been advocating for a peaceful solution. He always believed that there could be a middle ground that could be reached, and I think that's what could be taken away in ongoing conflicts, that we need to support those who are advocating for consensus building, who are advocating for a middle ground, and not give voice to those who are advocating for extremism and violence.
Well, Prasanna and Satish, thanks a lot for coming on and exposing our audience to a topic that, if not forgotten, is one that many people haven't been introduced to in the first place. In our last minute, can you tell us how we can follow the progress of your project, Neelan 25?
There's a website called neelan25.com. We are hoping to release the final product later this year. And you can log on to the website, submit your emails, and we can keep you updated on developments in the project.
I was going to mention that some of the cast that we have in the docuseries, because we have the former president and the prime minister, the current president of Sri Lanka. We have all the relevant key figures that were predominant during the conflict in Neelan's life. We interviewed those people. We interviewed the family. And so we all interviewed all the relevant stakeholders. So you get a very wide, eye-opening view throughout the entire film, really, the entire docuseries.
And the other thing I just wanted to mention was, Dr. Thiruchavam, his legacy is that he was not some radical leftist. He was killed for being a moderate. And because he was a moderate and he had a following, Mr. Prabhakaran or the LTTE were worried that his dominance, his voice was going to get diminished by a moderate who had a following. And the important thing to realize about Dr. Thiruchavam was he stayed true to his convictions, but he was a moderate. He was not some radical leftist or radical rightist. He was a middle-of-the-road moderate, and he was killed for being that.
Well, sometimes being in the middle of the road is the most dangerous place to be. We're out of time. I want everyone to stick around after the break. I'll be back with David Rovics. Thanks a lot for coming on again. It's Neelan, NEELAN25.com. Check it out, and we'll wait for the release of your documentary and talk again then. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favorite uncle that's taken you for walks in the park, however, that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio, a century of news